And I went out on a Saturday morning to play tennis and finish the game with my friend, and they drove up with a car and snatched me, stuck a gun in my ear and said, get in the car.
And as a correspondent, you're there trying to cover these things, and it must feel like all of a sudden, A, you're literally part of the story, but there must be like a queasiness, like, oh my goodness, I'm now becoming a distraction. How does, there has to be such a range of feelings going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as they pointed the gun at me, I knew I was in deep trouble because there had been a number of Westerners kidnapped, and most Western correspondents had left Lebanon. It was too dangerous. New York Times pulled their guy out a couple weeks before this happened.
Was there any question about whether you should stay or not? I mean, before, of course.
The president of the AP asked me continually, do you think it's time to leave? Do you think it's time to leave?
And why did you decide to stay?
It was an important story. I was the chief Middle East correspondent. I wanted to tell the story. Obviously, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have stayed that long. And I paid pretty seriously for the mistake. And, you know, I can't say that I would do it again. Obviously not.
Right.
At the time, I thought it was really important that at least a few Western correspondents be there to tell the story of what was going on in this terribly long war. And in the end, the war lasted 16 years.
6 years, 9 months, you were held captive.
Yes. 6 years, 9 months, and some odd days, yeah.
Does that when you look back now, 20-plus years later, does that time seem... how do you look back on that?
Oh, that's very odd. You know, at the time, it just seemed to go on forever and ever and ever, as you can imagine. It's not like a prison term. You don't get to cross off the days. You don't have an end date.
Right.
And you know, at first you think, well, this could be a long time. This could go on for 6 months or a year. And then it does. And then another year and another year and another year. And then suddenly the day comes and you walk free and it's all over.
Do you almost, you must almost in some ways almost lose sense of time. It's like, oh my goodness, it just feels almost interminable.
You lose sense of time. It seems like every day goes on forever, and then you turn around and suddenly it's been 5 or 6 years. And, you know, think about everything that happened while I was in prison. The world changed. The wall fell in Berlin. South Africa went to a popular government instead of the white domination. Marcos fell in the Philippines. All of the Soviet Empire turned toward openness and democracy. And here I come walking out, and it's like a different world.
And did you know any of that stuff would had happened, or you were pretty much had been kept in isolation?
Well, especially toward the end, the last year or two, they allowed us to have a radio. So we learned what was going on in the world, and we heard, you know, about the incredible efforts being made by people on our behalf, which was fascinating. You really didn't understand how important it became to people all over the United States until you came home. And I don't know if you remember that ticker tape parade and the huge, wonderful, warm welcome I got when I finally went free in December of 91.
I want to ask you a little bit about that, because that had to be an amazing experience. But they often talk about this Geneva effect, where you start to actually have some almost feelings for your captors, or start to understand. Did you ever go through those moments, or did you jump all? Did one day you're saying, "Okay, yeah, okay, I got it." The next day you're just very angry that you're there.
Well, I never detected any Stockholm syndrome by any of us.
Yeah.
They knew we hated them. They didn't like us. Some of them were pretty vicious boys. But you had to get along from day to day. I mean, you're in there for a very long time, and you have to deal with the guards. You have to talk to them. You have to, as we tried, try to make them understand, hey, we're hostages. We're not convicts. We didn't do anything to you.
No.
We're not here to be punished. And so you talk to them and you try to convince them to see you as a human being, even when that's very difficult. But no, I never sympathized with them.
And there were a group of you that were held together, and some of them, we were talking before we started, Father Lawrence Jenko, who was the priest at the church that I went to when I was out at USC out in California, he became a very, very good friend of yours.
Oh, he was my mentor. He was my friend. He was a marvelous man. I call him the closest thing to a saint I've ever met.
Yeah.
Acknowledging that saints are not always easy people to get along with. they kind of expect high standards of you, you know, and they get disappointed when you don't meet them. But Father Marty was a wonderful man. And I cherish the time I spent with him, both in prison and after we both came home. Unfortunately, he died of cancer only a couple years after I came home.
Yeah. December 4th, 1991, you finally get released. Talk a little bit about those feelings, because it had to be, it had been a long, long time, more than almost 7 years.
You know, we had known it was coming. There was a series of hostage releases over the past year or so before the end, and some of the hostages from my cell were released gradually until there were just four of us, and then one of them went home. And then the other two went home, and I was left there by myself, the last one, and that lasted a couple of months. So I knew I was going to be released, but after all that time, you can't let yourself believe it. I mean, you've been disappointed so many times. Our guards used to regularly come and tell us, you know, the negotiate is good, you go home soon, and over years and years and years, and you stop believing it. So even though we knew it was happening, and I knew at the end I was the last one, there was no reason for them to keep me. They were going to let me go home until the actual night came, when they took me out and drove me in a car down the road and pushed me out of the side of the road. I didn't really believe it.
And was it difficult to come back and re-enter, and I'm using air quotes, which works so well on the radio, but normal life?
Oh, yeah. First of all, it was normal life. I mean, the welcome was incredible.
Yeah.
It was incredible. I mean, people were so warm and stayed that way for years. Even today, people come up and say, you know, I prayed for you for years. I had been damaged. You can't go through something like that for that long without being damaged. I didn't know how to talk to anybody. I didn't know how to communicate. There was a lot of things that even I didn't realize at the time that I had a problem. But I was lucky. I got some good counseling and some therapy, and I actually managed to move on with my life, and it's been fascinating. It's been different over the past 20 years, but I've certainly enjoyed it.
This program that airs on the National Geographic Channel, it airs Monday, January 17th, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Talk a little bit about what you hope comes out of that. Why do this?
Well, first of all, they did a marvelous job. The reenactments are, I mean, they're scary. They made me.
I was watching it last night, and I'll tell you what, I got a bit queasy. I mean, it was scary. Is exactly. I mean, I was like, oh my God, there. But for the grace of God, that's just terrifying.
Well, it brought back some pretty sharp memories. And then they interviewed me at length, and my daughter and her mother, and which is the first time they've ever done that. They haven't talked to anybody publicly. What do we hope to get out of it? I don't know. Just, I hope that when people see that program, that they will remember exactly who was doing what to whom. I mean, this is a very small group of people. They're radicals, like the group that attacked the Twin Towers, Al-Qaeda. They don't represent all of Islam or all of the Middle East, you know. I still like the Lebanese. I went back to Lebanon last summer for like the fourth or fifth time. And I hope that we can remember before 9/11, we didn't blame all the Arabs for this. We didn't blame all Muslims for this. And we shouldn't be doing that now. Remember who's our enemy. There's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, and most of them get along with us just fine.
And it has to be almost heart-wrenching that the folks who define the way so many people look at an entire region are the folks who, like the folks who kidnapped you.
Yeah, you know, I went back after 5 years, and I made a film about Lebanon, about the end of the war in Lebanon and their rebuilding efforts and how it looked then, simply because I wanted to tell people, hey, look, I was a hostage for a long time, and I know who did that to me, and it wasn't these people. It was not the Lebanese. It was a few people.
Yeah. Excellent. Anything I didn't ask you about that I should have? Anything that you want to tell
me? No, I'm still teaching journalism. I'm enjoying myself. I live on a small horse farm outside of Lexington, and I'm sitting here looking out the back patio at the horses, and I watched a couple foxes play this morning in the field, and it's good life.